This is going to be the first of our two-part series on the two-state solution. Of course, that has been in the news a lot with the conflict that is raging in Israel and in Gaza, and a lot of the members of the international community are trying to compel on Israel, or at least to bring to the forefront, this idea of a two-state solution. So I prepared for y'all on the Jewish History Podcast. I prepared a two-part series on the two-state solution. They've both been recorded, and please God, they will both be released this week. And they are released this week in tandem in honor of the Torch fundraiser that's happening this week. Our organization, the organization that I work for, it's Torch. And we have the Torch Center here in Houston, Texas. And this is a nonprofit, meaning that the only way that we can support our staff of the great rabbis and rabbitsons and pay the rent and do all the wonderful work of Torch, it's only via the generosity of our friends and supporters. We don't charge for our classes. We don't charge for our podcasts or for our facility here at the Torch Center. We don't have membership. Once a year, we reach out to our friends and our supporters and our listeners, and we ask them for their support. And that's happening right now. It's an online fundraiser. The website is givetorch.org. I'm going to have a link in the description of this podcast. Every donation is doubled, so you get a chance to amplify your donation. We have matchers that are there to help grow your impact. If you want to support the great work of Torch, of course, there's the Jewish History Podcast, and there's the entire suite of other podcasts here from the Torch Center in Houston, Texas. The way to do that, if you want to support us, is to please hit the pause button and visit givetorch.org and give what you can give to support the great work of Torch and the Torch Podcasts and the Jewish History Podcast. And I know that I've kind of struggled to record the podcasts the last couple of months or years, but you know, this is going to be the fourth episode that we recorded since October 7th. And again, there's going to be, please God, another one this week. It's already been recorded. So hopefully we're picking up some momentum here on the Jewish History Podcast, but give us a boost. There's actually a page on our fundraiser at givetorch.org where you can support the Jewish History Podcast, and you could show us how much you enjoyed the Jewish History Podcast, and that will give us a little boost of encouragement to make sure that we continue producing the Jewish History Podcasts. So visit the website right now, givetorch.org. And of course, my email address is rabbiwolbe@gmail.com. This Jewish History Podcast is dedicated by my dear friend Yaakov Bass, in loving memory, and Leila Nishmas, his grandfather, David ben Ephraim Abba. May his soul be elevated in heaven. In the aftermath of the worst Palestinian terrorist attack on Jews, in an absurd twist of events, in a bizarre twist of events, many in the international community are calling for the recognition of a Palestinian state. Instead of seeking ways to punish the Palestinians for their evil, unconscionable crimes, the international community is seeking to reward them. Instead of viewing October 7th as the best example, perhaps, of why the Palestinians are unworthy of statehood, and maybe taking the possibility of a Palestinian state off the table, for some incomprehensible reason, the international community, the Americans, the Europeans, they began to talk in recent months about Palestinian statehood. And some went even as far as to say that unilateral acceptance of a Palestinian state, even without a deal with Israel, that's a possibility. Just a few weeks after the brutal massacre of innocent people, more than 1,200 men, women, and children in some of the most horrific ways, the American president said that we need to renew, this is a quote, we need to renew our resolve to pursue this two-state solution where Israelis and Palestinians can one day live side by side in a two-state solution with equal measure of freedom and dignity, two states for two people. And then he ended, and it's more important now than ever. The American president said, it's more important now than ever to pursue a Palestinian state. Like, now that these monsters murdered more than 1,000 innocent people, beheading and murdering and burning babies and raping women, going door to door to kill Jews. Now more than ever, it's important to try to give the Palestinians a state. It's absolutely absurd. Just a month ago, there was a report that the United States Secretary of State, he asked the State Department to, quote, conduct a review and present policy options on possible U.S. and international recognition of a Palestinian state after the war in Gaza. What this means, I don't know, but most likely it means to withhold the veto on the United Nations Security Council vote admitting Palestine as a full UN member state. Now, it's not just the Americans, the other allies, so to speak. The British Foreign Secretary David Cameron said in recent weeks that the United Kingdom is looking perhaps at recognition of a Palestinian state. Now, of course, this prompted a ferocious response from Israel. The suggestion to recognize a Palestinian state in the aftermath of what happened, it was thoroughly rejected by the entire spectrum of the Israeli public. And the politicians denounced it, both those who were in the government and those who were out of the government. And there was a vote that passed overwhelmingly in the Knesset that stated clearly that Israel thoroughly opposes any unilateral recognition of the Palestinian state. If there's going to be a deal, if there's going to be some accord with the Palestinians, it must be done through negotiation between the two sides and not dictated upon it by the international community. And this whole subject sprung up in a seemingly coordinated way. And it's not clear to me if this is just, you know, political expedience, political posturing. Is it perhaps a threat to Israel to don't finish the job in Gaza? But regardless, this is a terrible idea. And I'm willing to go out on a limb and say that a Palestinian state, it's not going to happen in the foreseeable future, likely never, because it's just a terrible, awful, no good idea. For a very long time, there's been this idea, this proposal, some version of it, a two-state solution. We only have one land, and they claim it, and they claim it, and they each maybe have historical claims. We're not going to go back thousands of years and figuring out who the proper owner is. Let's just carve out space for both of them. Two states for two people living in blissful harmony and prosperity. That has been the dream of the foreign policy establishment for as long as any of us can remember. And it's not one side of the aisle. It's bipartisan. This is what the previous president advocated, and the one before him, and the one before him, and the one before him, and so on. The Americans are under the impression that the only long-term solution to the Israeli-Arab, to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a two-state solution. One of the members of the administration said just recently, quote, "The only long-term answer to peace in the region for Israel's security in the region is a two-state solution." But the truth is, this is not a solution. This is actually something that would exacerbate problem. There are other solutions that will actually work. But if there were to be a Palestinian state, Israel's security would be doomed. If there was an Arab state that's so close, striking distance, within a stone's throw of Israel, Israel's security would be shattered. And that's the subject I want to talk about today in this discussion and in the one that will follow on this Jewish History Podcast, the two-state solution. I think it's hard for us. It's hard for the Americans, hard for the Europeans. People who live in democracies, in Western democracies, people who are educated in Western universities. I think it's hard for us to understand the core of the conflict. We think of it as maybe a border dispute. It's a nationalistic conflict. Two nations have claims on a given parcel of land. That's a problem that you solve with a two-state solution. Do you cut it like this? Do you cut it like that? Is it the 67 border? Is it, do we take into account the large settlement blocks? But the major contours of all plans are the same. But the truth is, it's not simply a nationalistic conflict. It's much more a religious dispute, an irreconcilable religious dispute. It's more that than anything else. In fact, the whole notion of Islamic nationalism, it's very, very new. Of course, there are Palestinian nationalist movements, but at the heart of the matter, the conflict is religious. You know, Hamas is not a Palestinian organization. It's an Islamic resistance movement. Palestinian nationhood, it's a very new thing. It's not more than 100 years old. And even then, it was promoted by a very small group. There is an Islamic ideal. It's been around since Islam was founded in the 7th century. The idea of Pax Islamica, this universal Islamic rule, that is the Islamic ideal. Everyone could get along. Everyone could be Muslim. You don't have to have nation states. There's no need for borders even. In the Islamic view, everyone can and everyone ought to be Islamic. That was the plan all along. The heretics, the non-believers, they have a choice. You convert or you are killed. And to be fair, Islam does recognize a permanent underclass of monotheists, namely the Jews and the Christians. But more broadly speaking, this idea of there being different nation states is a new idea in the Islamic world. And specifically with respect to the Palestinians, Palestinian peoplehood, it's a relatively new phenomenon. It's about 50 years that we started calling it the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Previously, it was just the Israeli-Arab conflict. And it's primarily rooted in Arab/Islamic intolerance to a Jewish foothold, a Jewish state in what we could call Palestine in Israel. And it wasn't about establishing an independent Palestinian state as much as it was rejecting a Jewish state. And in fact, the initial plan, 100 years ago, when the Arabs resisted the Balfour Declaration, they didn't want an independent state. Initially, they wanted that land, the land of Palestinia, land of Israel that we call today land of Israel, that was supposed to be a southern province of an Arab state whose capital was going to be established in Damascus. It was to be part of Syria. And then subsequently, they want to be part of Jordan. This is actually why the Kingdom of Jordan used to be called the Kingdom of Transjordan, because it was limited to the other side of the Jordan. But because they wanted to maintain solidarity with the other Palestinians on the other side of Jordan, they renamed themselves the Kingdom of Jordan. And once the Palestinian peoplehood movement was founded in the 60s, how did it start? It started as effectively a branch of Jordan. You look at the Palestinian flag and you compare it to the Jordanian flag. It's the same thing, with the exception of a star. This notion that there was this, Palestinian people historically, it's just fiction. In fact, if you look at a lot of Islamic flags, and they're all the same. Compare the flag of Jordan to the flag of Palestine, to the flag of Sudan, Kuwait, United Arab Emirates, they're effectively identical. And that's because the Islamic ideal is a caliphate, is enormous swaths of land controlled by Islamic religious law. You ask a question, people claim that there are occupied territories. The occupied territories of the West Bank, where the Jews have established cities and towns. You ask the question, well, it's occupied from who? Is it Jordanian land that we're occupying? Is it Palestinian land? There was never a Palestinian state in history. Prior to 1967, This land was controlled by the Jordanians. The Jordanians are not even making a claim on it. They don't want it back. The truth is that we see a difference. They don't. It's Islamic land in their view, and it must be controlled by an Islamic power. And that logic that assigns the term occupied, that actually would apply to all of Israel, as we shall see. Now, some of the Palestinians' most famous advocates even admitted that the whole notion of Palestinian nationalism, it's really all about throwing the Israelis, throwing the Jews out. It's just a tactic to eliminate Israel. So to understand the heart of the conflict and why it is delusional to try to seek a neat two-state solution, we have to examine some of the deeply held Islamic perspectives on this type of dispute. What is the Islamic perspective on coming to an agreement with the infidels, with the non-Muslims? You know, we think of peace. You have an enemy and you have disagreements, and you could reach some sort of truce. You could come to some sort of armistice. You could have some sort of agreement that could be a permanent solution towards the conflict, and the conflict has been resolved. That's how we view these types of resolutions. In Islam, and I heard this, I'm not an expert in Islam, but I was listening to perhaps the greatest Islamic expert who's non-Muslim, Dr. Kedar, and he spelled out the historical perspective that I found to be very compelling. There's a definition of peace that exists in Islam, and it goes back all the way to the founding events of the religion, and it's completely different than what we are accustomed to. The idea of peace being a permanent state just doesn't exist. Peace with non-Muslims. There can be a state of limited non-combat with non-Muslims for a limited time. But Islam views itself as a religion for all people in all places at all times. And part of the obligation of the Muslim is to try to effectuate the universality of Islam. And the notion of accepting permanently non-Muslims, and especially in land that was previously occupied by the Muslims, that is totally anathema to them. So what do you do? How do you come to an arrangement with an enemy that you cannot vanquish, but you can come to any permanent solution that permanently accepts them? So there's this concept. It's called a temporary peace. And that means you're accepting this entity, this non-Islamic entity, temporarily, until the time is ripe that you can eliminate them. In the Islamic mindset, and I think this will be accepted, by the way, it's not just us as Jews talking about this. This is accepted by the Muslims. There is Islam, and that is the permanent law. And then there's the obsolete religions, and they must be banished. He said the Arabic words for this. There's the din haq and the din batal, which means the obsolete religions that must be gotten rid of, and then there's the permanent Islam. And thus, the Muslim cannot have a permanent agreement with the non-Muslims. And of course, this remains unspoken because, you know, this ideal is not at all compatible with modernity. He pointed out in his presentation that there actually was, or maybe is, a modern Islamic movement that did draw their political philosophy from the actual Islamic sources, and that is ISIS. ISIS was following the letter of the law, and that's why they were so thoroughly rejected by everyone. But what does it mean to have a temporary peace? If you cannot eliminate the heretic, there's this concept of tolerating them until you can destroy them. And the precedent of this goes all the way back to the founding of Islam. Muhammad was booted from Mecca by the heretics, and he made several attempts to try to recapture Mecca. And he went in the year 628, he went to try to attack it, and he discovered that his forces were outnumbered and outgunned, so he struck a deal. This is the Treaty of Al-Hudaybiyah. I'm probably mispronouncing that. 9 years, 9 months, and 9 days. They made a truce, an armistice, for 9 years, 9 months, 9 days, the old 999 plan. For about 10 years, they're not going to fight. Now, did Muhammad keep his word? Absolutely not. Once the people in Mecca were lulled into complacency, they were convinced that Muhammad would not threaten them, so they loosened their defenses, they went on trips of commerce, and that's when Muhammad attacked. And this is viewed as legitimate in Islam. Everything that Muhammad did, he was infallible in the eyes of the Muslim. It's legitimate to deceive the heretic and to give him a false sense of security that you are at peace with him and you accept him. And thus in the year 630, so this is 2 years into the 10-year peace agreement, Muhammad attacks Mecca, conquers it. All the heretics, all the idolaters are given an option. You can convert or you'll be slaughtered. This is the philosophy of Islam towards unconquerable heretics. There's a policy of temporary peace. And you wait. You bide your time. And whenever there's the ability to place the heretic, the infidel, in their place, you do it even if it is a middle of the duration of your peace agreement. That's the precedent of the treaty that Muhammad signed. Now, Israel actually has some peace agreements with Islamic countries. They have an agreement with Egypt, for example. What's the nature of this agreement? So, of course, as Westerners, we think, okay, there's an agreement. Everyone is happy with the terms and everyone's at peace with it. Dr. Kadar pointed out that the Egyptian ruler, Gamal Abdel Nasser, he went to the Sunni Religious Council and they issued a ruling, an Islamic religious ruling, that Egypt is mortal enemies with Israel forever until one of two things happen, either the end of time or the end of Israel. That was the religious ruling given to Egypt. Now we know that Egypt actually has a peace agreement with Israel. So we would think that that's the agreement, the peace agreement, that's a repudiation of that religious ruling. But I discovered today that Anwar Sadat, so that's Nasser's successor, he's the one who signed the Camp David Accords with Israel, that he made peace with Israel. He went to the same religious council and he asked for religious justification from this supreme religious council. Can we make a peace with Israel? And they said yes, based upon the precedent set by Muhammad in the year 628. You can make peace with the infidels until it's time to attack. We have a peace that's now lasted for 45 years. But at the very inception of this peace, it was established as a temporary agreement. Until their capacity to defeat us, to destroy us is achieved, there'll be a peace with us. You know, in the late 70s, the Egyptians realized that Israel's too powerful. You just simply can't defeat them. 1948, we had a war. Israel won. 90, 1956, again, 67, of course, the Six-Day War. The War of Attrition did not accomplish any of Egypt's goals. And even the Yom Kippur War that Egypt launched the surprise attack and was very successful in the initial phases of the war ended when Israel was on the doorstep of Cairo. So what's the solution? To create a treaty of the sort done with the heretics of Mecca. And the same religious authority that declared Israel's the mortal enemy forever, they said you can make peace because that's not a repudiation. It's a step towards its fulfillment. Now, this is not just the policy of the Egyptians. When Yasser Arafat, the Palestinian, when he started the peace accords of the Oslo Accords in the 1990s, what was his justification? How could he make a religious claim to make peace with the Zionists? It was also based upon this same precedent from 628, the same treaty. So this idea that, or this notion that the Palestinians, they simply want to live in peace and they'll just accept us. They'll accept Israel as a legitimate Jewish state on formerly Islamic lands. I'll never pounce. I'll never attack. It's just laughable. It's naive folly. Prior to this devastating attack in October, it was a time of heightened intranational infighting. There was, of course, this judicial reform that was very controversial, and there was an unprecedented amount of discord amongst the Israeli public. Many have attributed the attack to the perception of weakness among, in the eyes of the Arabs, how they viewed Israeli society. If there's protests and there's threats to boycott military service and reserve duty, maybe they, or the argument goes that they saw that this was a time of weakness and it's time to attack. And that's the perception forever in the eyes of our Islamic enemies. They all say from the sea, from the river to the sea. And you look at the emblems of the Palestinian Authority and Hamas and everyone, it's the whole state of Israel. And if we were to sign some sort of two-state solution, the fundamental perception that they are at permanent war with us and the treaty is only temporary, that will endure. We have a concern, and it's not a theoretical one. We have a belief. We understand. If you live in the Middle East, it's not the same thing as living elsewhere. And you understand, the Palestinians are nowhere near accepting a Jewish state and living peaceably next to their neighbors. What do they believe? What do the Palestinians think? What are the attitude of these millions of Arab Muslims that live in Greater Israel? So, of course, the Palestinian territories, there's Gaza, the Gaza Strip. That's been run by Hamas since 2007. And then there's the West Bank, Judea and Samaria. And that's broken down to area A, B, and C. And it's run by the more moderates. It's Fatah. It's the Palestinian Authority. What do the people in the streets believe? What's the rank and file? What do they think? How do they view their Jewish neighbors? The Americans, the Europeans, they want a two-state solution. Let's have everyone live in peace side by side. Is that possible? There were several polls that were conducted in the aftermath of October 7th, just to gauge, you know, Palestinian sentiment. Across the board, the Palestinians viewed the massacres of 10/7 as legitimate, and they celebrated it. More than 1,200 innocent people were brutally murdered. Over 200 Israelis taken hostage. Children, the elderly, civilians tortured and raped. More than 80% of the Palestinians in the West Bank they support this. It's a crazy thing to even suggest that there could be peace between these two peoples. And by the way, an amazing statistic. The popularity of 10-7 in the West Bank, in the more moderate bastions of Palestinians, it's actually higher. It's more popular in the West Bank than it is in Gaza. This, in their eyes, is legitimate resistance to the, quote, Zionist occupiers. Hamas is very popular in the West Bank, in Judea and Samaria. And the popularity of Hamas rose in the aftermath of 10-7. You want to be popular amongst the Palestinians? How do you boost your poll numbers? How do you win over public opinion? By killing innocent Jews in brutal, macabre fashion. There's no partner for peace here. There's another poll that I read about. They asked the Palestinians in the, quote, West Bank, who should lead the Palestinians? Who should be in charge? So the two top vote getters, one got 44% and one got 42%. One was Ismail Haniya, the head of Hamas, okay, terrorist. And one is Marwan Barghouti, also a terrorist. People whose hands are dripping with Jewish blood. And at 6% comes in the Holocaust denier, Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority. Where are the candidates that could lead these people towards peace? They just don't exist. Abbas, Mahmoud Abbas, Yasser Arafat's successor, he's like in year 20 of his 4-year term. And the reason why there haven't been any votes, any elections in 20 years is because they know that Hamas would win. Hamas is insanely popular in the West Bank, in the place where the Americans, where the Europeans, where the international community wants to put an independent Palestinian state. Are these partners for peace? It's so thoroughly absurd to make this suggestion. And again, in American media, there's the PA. They're more moderate. They're more reasonable. The truth is, the Palestinian Authority, it's not very different from Hamas. It's just a fallacy to say otherwise. A large percentage of the Palestinian Authority's budget, 7%, and probably went up big time since October 7th, 7% of the government's budget goes to pay stipends to families of people who killed Jews. These are the moderates. Who do they pay? Where does the money go for? It goes to those who kill Jews. Israeli journalist Amit Segal calculated, what would 7% of the Israeli budget cover? It covers the ministries of welfare, absorption, science, culture, sports, agriculture, and higher learning combined. And all that goes to pay stipends for murderers. If you want to make it big, as a Palestinian, you make a lot of money, you're incentivized to murder Jews. And this is baked into the culture. Who do they admire? Who do they hold in high regard? What entities are viewed as being legitimate, as being admirable in the Palestinian world? Listen to this. This I got a kick out of here. They made another poll. Listen to this. Who do the Palestinians look up to? Which entities in the region? So the top four vote getters, the Qassam Brigades, terrorist group, Islamic Jihad, terrorist, Al-Aqsa Brigade, and Hamas. Those are the only four entities that achieved popularities over 75%. And coming in at 0%, exactly zero, not a single one looks up to this entity, the United States of America, together with Israel, both at 0%. And at 2%, United Arab Emirates. And at 3%, the United Kingdom. Oh, and Saudi Arabia. So the Americans are bending over backwards, trying to help, trying to give them money, trying to give them support, twisting Israel to support them. 0% popularity in the eyes of the Palestinians. And who is popular? All the various terror organizations. And of course, this should come as no surprise. Valuing terrorism, it's baked into the educational system. It's baked into the religious system, in the culture in Palestine. They lionize terrorism. Who are schools named after? Great inventors, great scientists, great politicians or athletes, great business leaders. Schools, streets, squares, they're named after shaheeds, people who died killing Jews. They're willing to worsen the lives of their populace just to kill some Jews. And these are people we're going to make peace with? You know, people like us in the Western world, after the events of October 7th, we struggle to figure out, like, what was their rationale? What was their game plan? What was the strategy? What are they thinking? What was the long-term plan here? The truth is, we know what the long-term plan here is. They've been saying it explicitly all along. Who do they lionize? Who do they glamorize? Who do they hold in high regard? Jihad, killing Jews. And this is not something you make peace with. This is something you destroy. You've heard, I'm sure, people saying, Hamas is not something you could destroy. It's an idea. You can't kill an idea. So first of all, this is an idea. This is a real creative idea. Oh, brilliant idea to kill Jews. But you know what else is an idea? Nazism. There are certain ideas that you must do whatever you can to uproot and to eliminate. You cannot tolerate these. This they cannot endure. The notion that getting rid of Hamas, along with, of course, the inevitable civilian casualties, that's going to only strengthen Hamas, and therefore it should be done. That is as risible as saying, oh, if we bomb Germany, that's only going to encourage future Nazism. In my opinion, this is a very helpful way to think of Hamas. But again, Hamas is not so far from all the other groups of the Palestinian leadership. They're Nazis with just less capabilities. Do you imagine for a second that if Hamas had the ability to do their atrocities on a larger scale, you think they would refrain from it? You don't think if they could herd all of us into the gas chambers, they'd do exactly that without a moment of reflection or regret? You think if they had nukes, they wouldn't use it on us? But again, it's not just Hamas. Hamas, they're not the outliers. It's baked into the entire system. You have the PA, you have Hamas, you have the West Bank, you have the Gaza Strip, and it's effectively the same. Yes, they use different tactics, and yes, some are more overt of their plans, but fundamentally, they're the same. If you were to have a Palestinian state, it would irreparably and catastrophically endanger Israeli security. Just think of the proximity of the West Bank, of Judea and Samaria, to major Jewish centers. During the attack of October 7th, the farthest incursion into Israel was the city of Ofakim. That's about 20 miles, 25 kilometers away from Gaza. Tul Karim, a city that's just brimming with terrorists, it's 14 miles from Tel Aviv. What about all the other cities? Ra'anana, Kfar Saba, Afula, Be'er Sheva. These are all as close to Judea and Samaria, in the Judea and Samaria envelope, if you will, as much as the towns in the Gaza envelope, in the Otef Gaza, were as close to Gaza. I heard from one Israeli commentator, a Palestinian state risks turning Kfar Saba into what happened in Kfar Aza. There were only 5,000 people in the Gaza envelope. There are millions living the same distance from the borders of a would-be Palestinian state. If Israel were to erect a border separating itself from the, so to speak, Palestinian state, how big of a border would that be? The Gaza border, and we saw how porous that was, all told, it's 59 kilometers. A would-be Palestinian state would demand a border of 720 kilometers. If, God forbid, the Palestinians, if they got a state in the West Bank, in Gaza, in the way envisioned by the bright-eyed Americans and Europeans, by the international community, they'll have immeasurably greater resources than Hamas, and they'll have American-made weapons, and they'll be properly trained, and there's the potential, there's the risk, or there's the likelihood of them unleashing attacks that make 10-7 look like child's play. It could be 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times worse. The flag of the PLO, don't forget this, it's all of Palestine. This idea that they'll just accept Israel as a standalone country, it's something that they only did begrudgingly to gain some sort of international favor and credibility. But at the core, the PLO plan, it's identical to the Hamas plan. If the Hamas has the Al-Qassam Brigade, well, they have the Al-Aqsa Brigade, and they're the same thing. Many commentators have pointed out that Prime Minister of Israel, Netanyahu, he made a great strategic mistake by strengthening Hamas. And he did that in order to weaken the Palestinian Authority. Of course, everyone agrees now that it was a disaster to bolster Hamas. But the larger strategy of trying to balkanize and divide the Palestinians and to make Palestinian statehood an impossibility, that's the correct approach. And anything that can be done to weaken the PA and to make the possibility of a Palestinian state more remote, that is something that, based upon everything we know, will likely save many, many, many Jewish lives. Now, thankfully, Israel universally and categorically opposes this. Historically, when there was terror, sometimes it led to capitulation. It doesn't seem, at least up to this point, that Israel is bending and giving concessions as maybe they've done in the past. And again, they passed that law that rejected completely any solution that's foisted upon them by others. But certainly, looking at the situation, declaring a Palestinian state, it's just not the solution. So what is the solution? You know, everyone's trying to ask the question. Suppose Israel is successful in doing what they need to do in Gaza. Who's going to rule Gaza? Well, it's obviously not Hamas. So the Americans, the Europeans, and even some Israelis, they say, well, we have to get the Palestinian Authority there. The renewed Palestinian Authority, the reinvigorated Palestinian Authority. But the truth is, the PA, they're not part of the solution. They're part of the problem. Remember where they came from. They are the rebranded PLO. And after the Lebanon War, Israel sent Arafat and his cronies to Tunisia in exile. And for some reason, one of the worst decisions in Israeli history, Peres and Rabin, they decided to bring them back and to legitimize them and to give them weapons. This is the famed Oslo Accords. Give them weapons, give them territory, and give them the first steps of Palestinian statehood. It's hard to argue that this was not an abject failure. instead of using all these resources to build a state and to modernize and to learn to tolerate their neighbors, they turned their guns on the Israelis and they launched an intifada with suicide bombings, blowing up buses, blowing up restaurants. And then they were booted from Gaza in June of 07. The Fatah, the PA loyalists, were savagely killed by Hamas. They were chucked off the high buildings in Gaza. Visitors today would perhaps be surprised to learn that there used to be tall buildings in Gaza. But certainly, the PA is not popular, not in the West Bank and not in Gaza. There's zero chance that the PA will be a serious ruler in Gaza. For some reason, this is what the Americans want. This is what the Americans want. It's not going to happen. So what's the alternative? So there's the pie in the sky idea, bring in the Saudis, bring in UAE, bring in Qatar. Let them swoop in and save the day. It's not the solution either. Not for Gaza, not for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. There's been talk of a two-state solution for a very long time. It's not a new idea. It's a very old idea. And I have to say, it makes sense on paper. It's a neat resolution. There's two peoples living in the Holy Land, and they've been fighting over for a long time, and we're not getting into who's right and who's wrong. They both have legitimate claims. We're not going to debate thousand-year-old claims. Let's give it them both. That's the basic idea. And over the past century, there have been all sorts of proposals, and every single one of them was dead on arrival. And certainly, every time the Jews, perhaps foolishly, perhaps aspirationally, perhaps because they were so moored, they were so fastened, they were so connected to this false conception that peace is possible under the current circumstances, they always accepted it, and the Arabs always rejected it. And we'll see more about that, please God, next time. We'll go through the long and tortured history of the many, many, many two-state solution proposals. But every single one of them was rejected. Because fundamentally, a Jewish state, it's not tolerable to them. Even if the Jewish state is a square inch on the beach. We have to remember that. We have to believe our enemies. If there's anything that we need to know from Jewish history, is that it's a very, very good idea to believe your enemies when they lay out their beliefs and their plans. It's not always hyperbole or electioneering. We're Jews. We want peace. Israel made a decision. Some would argue bravely. Others would label this as naive. They made a decision to say that we're open for everyone. It's a Jewish state. But if you're Christian, if you're Muslim, if whatever you are, you can live here. And you're granted equality. And they bend over backwards to accommodate the Arabs. Arabic is official language. This full citizenship rights to all. Of course, in a Palestinian state, there would be no Jews. And you can't point out the double standard. The Israeli Arabs, they get to stay in Israel. But no Jews can remain in any Palestinian state, of course. And anytime you point out the double standard, they go nuts. There's so many double standards. I think of it as just being simply rooted in plain old vanilla anti-Semitism. You know, when ISIS slaughtered tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Muslims, there were no international protests and rallies. Assad kills 500,000 people in Syria. Well, where's the outcry? Where's the protests? Where's the rallies? Israel kills Hamas. And they have a much better terrorist to civilian casualty rate, way better than the Americans ever had. And they're fighting in these incredibly packed conditions and incredibly urban environments. And there's the outcry. And everyone's complaining. And all over social media and all over traditional media and everywhere. Israel's being condemned. A friend of mine, he went to the local city council because they were having a debate. This is the thing in America. All the city councils, they can't manage their own cities, but they want to make a declaration to try to institute a ceasefire in Israel. So my friend, Dr. Kritz, who I interviewed on my podcast, he went to Israel and told over the whole story. In the city of Raleigh, in the city council, they were having a debate about Israel-Palestine. And he said there were just swarms and swarms of Palestinian sympathizers. And they all have cousins who are in Gaza, all of them. Everyone's giving 1 minute to speak. And all he did was point out the inconsistencies and the hypocrisy. When they die in Yemen, you don't care. When they die because of ISIS, you don't care. When they die in Syria, you don't care. When there's atrocities in Saudi Arabia, you don't care. Only once the Jews are trying to defend themselves, only then do you suddenly get all hot and sweaty. That's all he said. So what'd they do? They played nice. They played fair. They go after him. They target him. They complain to the medical board. In 35 years of practicing, he had 2 complaints to the medical board. They submitted 54 complaints. 45 of them were anonymous. And they accused him of supporting genocide. All he said was, hey, Muslims are dying in all sorts of places, and suddenly it's only when the Jews are involved. Only then do you start protesting. They even started fabricating stories against him. They made up this whole story that he told a woman in the hospital, she was wearing a head covering, you shouldn't be allowed in here. This was all obviously dismissed by the medical board. But this is part of what we're growing up against. It's not just a coordinated attack against Israel there. It's everywhere. And I'm not going to say definitively that all anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, but as I mentioned in my podcast with Dr. Kritz, if there's a Venn diagram, it looks a lot like a circle. And one of the easy things that we could say is, well, let's just solve it. It's a two-state solution. And it's been tried. It's been proposed dozens of times. And each time it's a little bit different, but it's essentially the same. And it's never worked. What will work? Is there a good solution to Gaza, more broadly to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? Is it just helpless? Only Messiah, only God can solve this. Next time in our Jewish history series, next time in the Jewish History Podcast, we're going to propose some solutions. We're going to go through the long and tortured history of the various proposals and why they failed, why they were doomed, and what could possibly be a good solution going forward. I'm looking forward to that. My email address is rabbiwolby@gmail.com. I'm looking forward to hearing your feedback, and please God, studying this story yet further. We end in prayer for our brothers and sisters living in the war zone, the civilians, those who have been displaced from their homes, the soldiers in Gaza, of course, the hostages. We send our condolences to all those who were injured, and of course, the families of those who were killed. We hope they suffer no longer, and that only good happens to them and their families. They're in our prayers. We pray for them every day. And we hope to only hear good news from them. And hopefully we will merit to peace and stability in our time. Please die with the arrival of Messiah. May he come speedily in our days. And again, that email address is rabbiwolby@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast. Again, the website for the Torch fundraiser for the annual Torch fundraiser is happening right now. The website is givetorch.org. Every donation is doubled. Please visit givetorch.org. The link is in the description. Give a click on the link and give what you can give and support the great work of Torch in 2024. Again, the website is givetorch.org.